Our third case this morning is Fish v. Great Bank Trust Company, case number 12-3330. Mr. Greenwald?
Thank you, Your Honor. I might just...
Sure. Take your time.
May it please the Court, the plaintiff appellants contend here that the District Court committed multiple fundamental errors in its ruling on the statute of limitations when it dismissed the plaintiff's complaint on summary judgment number two. Error number one was the court's mischaracterizing the plaintiff's claims as based upon what he called the, quote, substance of the decisions, unquote, as opposed to the, quote, process, unquote, leading to the decision. Absent an imprudent process, there is no ERISA violation by fiduciaries making a decision that goes bad. The violation arises from the failure to comply with the rules and standards of conduct for fiduciaries set forth in ERISA, those standards being the duty of prudence, the duty of loyalty, the duty of exclusive dealing for the best interests of the plan participants, the duty of acting in good faith and ensuring that a transaction is for fair market value. It is those elements that give rise to the violation. Error number two was in the improper test for actual knowledge that was applied by the district court. The district court essentially held that disclosure of the details of a transaction alone was sufficient to trigger the statute of limitation, even though none of the fiduciary conduct was made known to the participants or to the fiduciaries, the successor fiduciary. Now, we believe and we contend that the district court misinterpreted Martin's holding that actual knowledge requires the plaintiff to know the essential facts of the transaction or conduct constituting the breach or violation. The district court read out of that holding the terms constituting the breach or violation and instead simply applied the language the transaction. What the standard of Martin called for was an actual knowledge of the facts in the transaction that relate to the fiduciary conduct giving rise to the breach or violation. In the case of a prohibited transaction under Section 406 of ERISA, that meant they needed to understand what was the fiduciary conduct and how did it give rise to a violation of ERISA. I would direct the court to the Martin case on that issue because it very clearly, in dealing with the bidding claims in that case, explains what is necessary for actual knowledge. In that case, the court essentially found that over a three-year period, the Department of Labor first learned that there was an indictment for bid rigging, then that there was a conviction for bid rigging, then they got the documents that showed the bid proposals and the bidding documents. And finally, they did an investigation which led them to change the file from an open investigation to a fiduciary breach. It was on that basis that you get to actual knowledge. In our case, there was no actual knowledge. And that brings us to error number three. There, the court simply said that the proxy, which was provided to all the participants, an over 200-page document, provided actual knowledge. And the court, as an illustration, pointed us to, I think it's page 70 of the proxy, where it talks about the disclosure of the repurchase obligation and how it might result in, if things don't go right, the corporation becoming insolvent and the company being unable to pay the repurchase obligation. So it disclosed the risks.
Well, that risk is inherent.
Yes, Your Honor.
That risk is inherent in any ESOP with that kind of repurchase obligation, right? If it's privately held, the price is set too high, you're going to have a stampede, right?
No, because in many cases it depends how old the ESOP is, whether the repurchase obligation has gotten to a level. It's grown over the years.
Yeah.
In this case,
but
it's 1978.
It's inherent in the design. So there's really, I mean, the fact that an inherent risk is disclosed really doesn't tell you very much.
It doesn't tell you anything. For example, it doesn't tell you that there were assumptions that were made in getting to the repurchase obligations that were not reasonable. It doesn't explain that the assumptions weren't even known by the trustee. It doesn't explain the projections of the annual repurchase obligation were unreasonable. It doesn't tell you that Great Bank Trust never did anything to determine the reasonableness of the assumptions or the projections. It doesn't explain that the projections that were used were outdated by the time of the transaction. And lastly, it doesn't explain that there was no reassessment of those projections in light of certain events that occurred between the negotiation of the deal and the closing.
Are those
namely
flaws,
the
are those flaws separately actionable from the flawed transaction itself?
Interesting question. I mean, it could be, because the way the actual knowledge standard is set up, it's actual knowledge of the particular breach or violation that's being asserted. Unfortunately, we never had knowledge of that breach or violation, the actual details of it, until we received the fairness analysis after the case was filed. So,
right, but I guess my question goes to whether the flaws in the process that you've just kind of ticked through, the fiduciary investigative process, stand on sort of their own footing for purposes of an ERISA claim, or are simply evidence of what was wrong with the transaction?
No, I think that it's evidence of the deficient process, and that's what we're talking about here.
It's a distinct form of fiduciary breach.
No, I think that it's simply the deficient process which led to the decision to approve the transaction for the price that it was set for, and that was the problem, that deficient process. And part of it, if you understand from our briefing, all of that repurchase obligation went into what's called the debt coverage analysis, which was part of the fairness analysis, and it was necessary to determine whether the company was going to be able to cover the debt over the next 10 years and beyond, and the use of those unreasonable projections as a result of fault in the process is what caused this problem. Now, Your Honor, I would also want to address the fundamental error that was committed in dismissing Evolve from this case, a very, very important part of this case. Now, the one thing that was unusual about this case as to Evolve, there was never a motion that was filed to dismiss Evolve. It was not in the motion to dismiss. It wasn't in the motion for summary judgment number one or a motion for summary judgment number two. In fact, in the second motion for summary judgment, the defendants specifically indicated that their motion was brought as against the individual plaintiffs, and they merely referenced the fact that Judge Shader had in prior decisions determined that there was manipulation in inserting the Evolve into the transaction. However, Judge Shader's footnote, which came from the decision in summary judgment number one, was mere dictum, and it was not based on any motion, nor was it based on any evidence in the record.
Can I ask you a quick question about that, Mr. Greenwald, concerning Evolve? Is there any reason why Evolve could not have filed a separate complaint?
Yeah, well, they could have, but the problem was that Evolve was working for a company that was dead broke, was out of money.
Mm-hmm.
They had
yeah,
a fiduciary obligation under 405 that they had to follow, but by joining in the lawsuit, they were able to have essentially contingent attorneys perform on a contingent basis and protect the rights.
But you all could have, if you wanted to, simply filed a separate complaint, right?
We could have, yes.
It would have been consolidated.
We could have, and it probably would have been consolidated.
At least coordinated. Is there anything unusual about mixed results for different plaintiffs, depending on individual defenses that apply to them?
Well, I think that if you have certain of the defendants that have actual knowledge, if that's what you're referring to, while others don't, then the ones that have actual knowledge would be dismissed out, and the ones that, that don't have actual knowledge would be able to proceed with the case. That's what Landwehr versus Dupre said.
Yeah, and Evolve doesn't... You can argue about whether knowledge should be imputed to it, but I don't understand how imputed knowledge can be actual knowledge. But that's something we'll leave for later.
That's right. The only case out there that was seemingly relied upon here is the New Orleans employers case, which was a rather unusual case, where they were the court found that the knowledge of a current fiduciary could be imputed to a co-fiduciary because the original fiduciaries had brought in the co-fiduciary to bring the claim. Now, there's no authority whatsoever to suggest that any actual knowledge of participants can be imputed to a fiduciary, a successor fiduciary, or vice versa. And what the district court completely forgot was Section 405A3 of ERISA, which holds a successor fiduciary liable for the acts of a predecessor fiduciary if the successor learns of a breach by the predecessor and fails to take reasonable and adequate steps to remedy the breach, namely filing the suit. So what...
Your time is up at this point, but I could just ask you very quickly, how big a group of affected employees are we talking about who stayed in the plan and have similar claims here?
There was, as I recall, there was 1,200 to start. There was 800 that left, but most of them left because they didn't leave on their own.
So it's in the hundreds.
They were left in a scale down, but they were replaced by others. So it was a fairly large ESOP.
In the hundreds.
Pardon? Yes, sir.
If people who are like your plaintiffs.
Yes.
And how much money is at stake?
How much money was lost?
How much money is at stake for people similarly situated in your view?
Well, over $60 million.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, and you spent your time with the Department of Labor, so your time is up. Mr. Dolan.
May it please the Court, I'm Peter Dolan for the Secretary of Labor as amicus curiae. Mr. Greenwald received a question about whether or not alleged deficiencies in the fiduciary's decision-making by themselves without reference to the terms of the transaction, could be a fiduciary breach. The short answer is yes. This Court's decision in Brock against Robbins in 1987 shows this. In that case, the Court held that even though the price was right in that case, it was a contract for claims administration services, the responsible fiduciary nonetheless could still have been imprudent if it approved the contract without employing adequate care, skill, analysis, or diligence. Now, back to the actual knowledge issue in this case. In the statute of limitations section 413, the term actual knowledge means personal knowledge of the essential facts of the breach or violation that's been pleaded by the plaintiffs. Actual knowledge, therefore, requires much more than either just constructive knowledge or some notion of inquiry notice. In this case, the plaintiffs alleged two types of violations. One was violations of the prohibited transaction rules in Section 406 of the statute. The other type of violations were imprudence in violation of the prudence standard in Section 404. Facts relevant to fiduciary prudence are relevant to both categories of claims under the term prudence and the prudence standard and through the adequate consideration exemption to the prohibited transaction rules. Now, this case, very briefly, is essentially about an imprudent, allegedly imprudent investment decision by Great Bank. Here, because the plaintiffs did not know on a transaction, Great Bank's reasoning behind the decision the Great Bank made to approve the deal, the plaintiffs could not have had actual knowledge that
Dolan,
given
the timing of, Mr. Dolan, given the timing of the briefing, you did not have an opportunity to address the theory that the defendants have developed here concerning differences between elements and affirmative defenses depending upon which party has the burden of proof on the issue. Could you address that with respect to the actual knowledge requirement?
Yes, I can. I would make two points in response to your question. The first is that for the three-year limitations period, the actual knowledge must be actual knowledge of the entire breach or violation. Under the prohibited transaction rules, with respect to the prohibited transaction rules, with respect to a prohibited transaction violation, and this is probably the better term, actual knowledge of the violation requires knowledge of both the bare terms of the transaction and then also actual knowledge of facts that make the transaction non-exempt under the terms of an applicable exemption.
I understand the conclusion. Can you help give us some legal arguments or authority that would guide us either? We'll ask the same questions of the other side as well, but there's not a lot of guidance here.
Mm-hmm. The statutory text of the prohibited transaction rule, section 406, starts out with this phrase, quote, except as provided by section 408. And 408 is the exemption section. Therefore, the transaction is prohibited only if it's listed in 406A, and it's not exempt under the exemption section.
Let me try again. Are you aware of any other court that has adopted or rejected the theory that the defendants have put forward to us to distinguish between elements and affirmative defenses on that prohibited transaction analysis for purposes of statute of limitations?
I am not aware of such decisions.
So we're on our own.
As far as I know, yes. As you kindly pointed out, the department wasn't able to brief that question.
Okay.
My light is on. I need to stop.
Thank you. Mr. Becker?
Your Honor, in answer to your last question, Mr. Hamilton, I think the Brown case, which we cited, sets forth the statutory structure, and also the Montgomery case, which we cited.
Well, Brown, both sides are reading way too much into Brown, and you spend a good deal of time arguing against it in your brief, right?
On a different ground, Your Honor, yes. But in terms of the statutory construction, it's very clear. And I think that the Department of Labor attorney just said so as well, that except as is provided in 408, you have a prohibited transaction. If the fiduciary does a transaction with a party in interest, and then the fiduciary's burden shifts. That's a prima facie prohibited transaction. And then under 408E, the fiduciary has the burden to show that it's an exempt transaction, that it's for adequate consideration, fair value, fair market value, and in good faith, which courts such as Brown have construed as a prudent process.
The language in Brown on this point is pretty clearly dictum. The Fifth Circuit's decision in Maher against, I think, Strahan Shipping or something like that, that you've also criticized, looks like a holding here, that the three-year actual knowledge statute of limitations doesn't start to run where the plaintiffs don't yet know about the allegedly defective process that the fiduciary used. Do you agree that we would need to disagree with the Maher case in order to affirm here?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that you would. And I believe it's wrongly decided, the reason being that plaintiffs, basically Maher reads the three-year statute out of ERISA. The DOL, in its brief, stated that seldom, if ever, does any plaintiff know before bringing a lawsuit.
Right. It's been used most often against the DOL itself.
Precisely.
It? Yeah.
And so I don't know why the plaintiffs are seeking this relief, but what they're really asking this court to do is to say that they are responsible for undertaking a burden that ERISA does not place with them and something that they would never have reason to know. So how would they ever pass the Twombly or Iqbal standard? How would they plead an improper process that they don't know about? I think that ERISA is structured and needs to be read in context, and the context is that the burden shifts to a trustee because all that the beneficiary or the Department of Labor needs to allege is the existence of a prohibited transaction, or in the case of 404, is what basically Martin talks about, which is something more than things are awry, but something less than every detail. I know that's a difficult standard to apply, but on that continuum.
It's a very difficult standard to apply, particularly if you're trying to decide when you have to file your complaint.
On that continuum, though, I think that this case is not a hard case, because what we have is not just the disclosure materials, which were very extensive, but the court also had in the record and considered everything that happened in the 2.5 years after the transaction. The fact that and it wasn't just Judge Sykes or Judge Hamilton, the inherent risk of an underprojection of repurchase obligation. It came to light that the repurchase obligation was actually underestimated tenfold. Instead of an $11 million repurchase projection in the first year after the transaction, there was a $111 million repurchase obligation, money out the door, participants out the door. That's injury. And so we contend that when you have the actual knowledge of the transaction and you have the magnitude of the injury that occurred in this case, then you have way more than is necessary under the Martin standard for actual knowledge.
You have at least inquiry notice. Let me ask, if you could, Mr. Becker, about a point that was raised in the reply, that the defense argued in the district court that this transaction was actually not even subject to 406. Is that right?
The defense argued that the transaction was not subject to 406. Yes.
Why?
Because we don't believe that the ESOP was not a party to the transaction. That's why.
So, okay, I thought it applied to indirect transactions, right?
Well, that's what the plaintiffs contended, and for the purpose of their allegations.
But you're saying they don't even have a prima facie case, right?
Well, they have a prima facie case as they pled it, certainly, Your Honor. And they say an indirect transaction took place that was a prohibited transaction. The important point for 413, point two, the three-year statute of limitations, is that all of the participants knew that. They knew that it was a transaction that the ESOP had to not tender its shares into in order for the transaction to take place at all. And they knew that the other defendants were members of the ESOP committee, and they were tendering their shares in the transaction. And they admitted all of those things in deposition testimony as well.
Right. All that is to say that they knew what the terms of the transaction were back in 2003 at the time of the transaction, because those disclosures were made, and to the extent that the claim of fiduciary breach and prohibited transaction breach rests on the transaction terms, then the claim is untimely. But to the extent that the claim rests on an inadequate or imprudent investigation, those details, they did not acquire actual knowledge of those details until much later within the limitations period. And that was the import of my question about whether that's a separate fiduciary breach actionable under ERISA, either as a breach of fiduciary duty or a violation of the prohibited transaction rule because it doesn't fall within the exception.
I don't believe so because it all relates back to the transaction, Your Honor.
And there are damages, but
that goes to the actual knowledge. The damages were manifested within the 3 years after the transaction and more than 3 years before the lawsuit was filed. And I don't believe, Your Honor.
But the problem is, as I'm sure you would want to argue on the merits, that just the fact that the decision turns out badly is not a violation of ERISA, is it?
That's our defense. That's
right.
Exactly my point. But we have a right to bring that as a defense, and it's not an element of the plaintiff's claim. They should be happy to accept that, but obviously they don't because this is in the context of a statute of limitations claim, but they can't have their cake and eat it too. The problem is that if they want to undertake in all cases going forward the burden of proving an inadequate investigation when ERISA, the statutory framework, assigns that as an affirmative defense to the defendants, so be it. But they're going to have a very difficult time proving cases going forward. If I may address Evolve for just a moment. Evolve brought no new claims. Evolve only was added as an additional party once it became clear to the plaintiffs that we were going to bring a statute of limitations motion to dismiss.
It's a separate plaintiff. It has its own standing. It could bring its own complaint, right?
Well, it's a separate plaintiff because, yes, it's named above the V, and it has standing under 502A2. It's one of the categories, a participant, beneficiary, fiduciary, the Secretary of Labor, who can bring an ERISA claim. But it's not the plan. And the plan's knowledge is what counts here. It's not the knowledge of anybody you get off the street, and especially somebody who you get to.
So is it Great Bank's knowledge that matters?
It could be any of the successor trustees who were non-breaching, as the Landwehr case points out. But what it can't be is just a successor trustee who's added after the fact as a plaintiff without knowledge, specifically because they have no knowledge. That's manipulative violation
it was chosen,
of the statute.
The new Evolve was chosen by defendant Mr. Morgan, correct?
It was the successor trustee, but it had no knowledge, and it's the plan's knowledge, the point that I'm trying to make that counts. It's not the knowledge of the person who happens to be on the caption. It's the plan's knowledge.
All right, thank you. Mr. Shire?
Good morning, Your Honors. I guess I'd like to start maybe where Mr. Becker left off and maybe fill in, kind of backfill a response to Judge Hamilton's question. I think you have to look at this case contrary to Landwehr, or you have to look at these cases generally at who the real plaintiff is. And Judge Shader recognized this in opinion. The real plaintiff is the plan. When you look at the statutory construct, you can't just review Section 413(2) in isolation. You need to take a look at who holds the duty. The duty that's being breached is a plan fiduciary, and the duty runs to the plan, not to any individual plaintiff, not to any trustee. So you start there. You have designated plaintiffs in 1132 or 502A2, beneficiaries, fiduciaries, the Secretary of Labor, and they're able to bring claims to remedy under 409. 409 provides that the damages that are collected go to not an individual plaintiff, but to the plan. And it is also to the plan that the duty runs, the duty of the fiduciaries that was allegedly breached. And under 406, the prohibited transaction is one between a party in interest and the plan. So the way you need to look at this case, and I'd urge you to look at this case, is similar to the way the court out of the Northern District of Georgia did in the Longshoreman's decision, which I think is solid reasoning, and that is you need to judge, or you need to, when you're looking for actual knowledge and what triggers statute of limitations, you need to look at the knowledge of the plan. Well, a plan doesn't have a brain, and a plan doesn't have eyes, and a plan doesn't have arms and legs, so you need to not impute knowledge. You need to determine how does a plan or how does a corporation gain knowledge sufficient to trigger a statute. I would argue, as the court held in Longshoreman's and contrary to Landwehr, that you need to look at knowledge of either a non-breaching fiduciary or a plan beneficiary, or some other agent
One plan beneficiary enough?
I believe it is.
To stop the plan from asserting its rights?
I believe so.
It would have to be a non-breaching beneficiary?
Or a non-breaching fiduciary. Because that's where I thought Judge Reinhart maybe deviated into a wrong direction. His policy concern with finding the plan as the proper plaintiff was, in every case, if you're going to use the knowledge of a fiduciary, well, then it would be the breaching fiduciary. I think there's judicial exceptions all the time to statutes of limitations. It's easy to craft an exception whereby a breaching fiduciary's knowledge for equitable purposes, if nothing else, is not the proper trigger. But if
that
in the
would
case,
seem to make for a pretty good argument on the plaintiff's failure to sue claims in this case against your clients.
The failure to sue claim in
failure to sue Great Bank.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can address those claims as well.
They seem to be pretty closely linked on this issue. Then, if you're telling us we should focus on the knowledge of a non-breaching fiduciary.
You do focus on, the knowledge, in this case, I would urge, is it's not a non-breaching fiduciary. It's the knowledge of the individual plaintiffs. And, in fact, the entire plan. So if you find that, which I believe this record is not a difficult record in terms of the actual knowledge of the individual plaintiffs to trigger the statute of limitations, because I think it falls squarely within that spectrum between knowledge that tells you something was awry and knowledge of every last detail. Once you reach that conclusion, I think it
the statute requires actual knowledge of the breach in question, and if the breach, again, focuses on the inadequate investigation, the imprudent investigation in a number of respects, these individual plaintiffs did not have actual knowledge of that until well within the limitations period.
Well, Judge Sykes, these individual plaintiffs were able to file their complaint without that knowledge, and they filed the complaint in March 2009, and there's no evidence in this record of any fact that was discovered after.
Suggests that there's different aspects to this claim, but to the extent that part of the fiduciary breach claim rests on the inadequate investigative process on the part of the fiduciaries, the actual knowledge of that wasn't acquired until discovery.
Well, that's after the lawsuit was filed, but I'm probably not being articulate enough. What I'm explaining is that this lawsuit was filed.
I understand that. And it's this, you know, the statute of limitations analysis keys off of the fiduciary breach in question, or the in this case we've got a fiduciary breach claim and a prohibited transaction claim that the plaintiffs allege does not fall within the exemption for adequate consideration. So, I mean, those are the two claims here, but they have different aspects to them. It's not just a challenge to the transaction's merits or demerits. It's a challenge to the process that was used to put it in place.
I can address that.
And whether those are dual claims, a unitary claim, that's the conceptual difficulty here.
My understanding is that the claim they are prosecuting under 404 is a process claim. Now, my clients weren't involved in that process. They had abdicated their fiduciary duties pursuant to 405C to Great Bank for that purpose. But what Great Bank did or didn't do goes to the merits of the claim. When you're talking about a statute of limitations trigger, you look on this record what the individual plaintiffs knew. What they knew was there was a transaction. They knew the transaction price. They knew that the company took an immense risk borrowing.
Why is it limited to the merits of the transaction and not the investigation?
Well, I think this will go to show that they understood Great Bank was a fiduciary. They understood it was disclosed to them that there was an independent fiduciary who hired independent financial advisors, who hired legal counsel. The record's clear that there was knowledge of a transaction and the price of that transaction, the large risk associated with the transaction, borrowing upwards of $200 million, more than these plaintiffs.
They knew nothing about the process.
Well, but the issue is whether the statute of limitations is triggered to know you have a claim that there is actual knowledge of an injury, that something was wrong. Of a breach. And here, within a year after the transaction, Lee Morgan disclosed to all claimants that the repurchase obligation, very unexpectedly and surprisingly, was well above the projections of either Great Bank or the company at the time to the magnitude of tenfold, and that the following year to the magnitude of fivefold, and that the company had already tripped loan covenants and was having serious financial difficulties. So what happens in this case, what should happen in the practical world is you file your lawsuit because there's a real problem with that transaction, and you do your discovery. And that's precisely what the plaintiffs did in this case. They filed their lawsuit. They've admitted they didn't. I think, is it Mr. Dyer that said no one knew what Great Bank did? No one could know what Great Bank did. They did something behind the curtain, yet they were able to file their lawsuit. And then you know how the system works? Then you undertake discovery and you begin to develop your substantive case. So it's I think what the plaintiffs are confusing here is evidence needed to prove the merits of the claim versus evidence needed to trigger a statute of limitations. It's a very, very different standard. They didn't need specific knowledge of what Great Bank did or didn't do. They filed the lawsuit without that knowledge. And they gained that knowledge after the lawsuit. Whatever they're telling you about now that Great Bank did or didn't do, Mr. Greenwald went on for minutes about they didn't do this and this was unreasonable. Those are facts they purportedly discovered post-lawsuit. But they could file their lawsuit without knowing those facts. And that's the point. There's nothing in that complaint. There's not a single fact in that complaint that they learned after March 2006. I urge you to go back and read the allegations in that complaint, the process allegations as well, were all facts that were derived from the enormously comprehensive pre-transaction disclosure.
We were told that a good deal of that what was alleged and what we've been told was developed through the bankruptcy process.
I read that in a brief. I read that a plaintiff's lawyer had looked at some bankruptcy documents that were unidentified in their briefs. There's nothing in the record about that. There's no citation to that in their complaint. I can only live with the record that's developed. When I get a reply brief that says Mr. So-and-so looked at some unnamed generic documents from a bankruptcy production, I don't know what they're talking about. What I do know is I read the complaint on record, and every fact in that complaint that forms the basis of a process claim or a substantive challenge to the transaction, Judge Sykes, if that's also what they're pursuing, was known to these plaintiffs. And when they're able to file the I think they really are talking out of both sides of their mouth, when they're able to file the complaint without any knowledge they gained after, within 3 years of filing the lawsuit, and on the other hand tell you, we the plaintiffs, are not going to, the statute of limitations wasn't triggered until we know exactly what Great Bank did. It really is an every last detail standard. And Martin tells you that's not the way the world works in the Seventh Circuit. It might in the Third Circuit, but not in the Seventh Circuit.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Greenwald, you were out of time, but we'll give you two extra minutes.
Didn't I reserve two minutes?
You did, but you ran out. But we kept you at the podium, so you can have them back.
Points real fast.
Okay. Yeah.
I get very upset when I hear nothing in the record because we wanted to put something in the record, but the way the district court set down this motion for summary judgment, we never had a chance. I won't go back over that again.
I've read that transcript and have some concerns about the process and the way it was quoted. What were the threshold issues the district judge said he wanted to consider before the full-blown summary judgment process? Do you remember?
Well, there was two, but it turned out there was one. And the issue was, does inquiry notice constitute actual knowledge under Section 413? Frankly, I don't know where
it obviously does not.
The district court judge got that because in the first summary judgment, that issue had been dealt with, but that's what the judge felt was the issue. He asked Mr. Becker, are you suggesting that inquiry notice applies under the actual knowledge standard? And he said yes, and he directed us to do that, and we filed a brief on that issue, and we made it clear two or three times that we wanted to file a brief on the merits and go through the facts if the court was going to look at this thing seriously. That's all I'm going to say on that. Just quickly, some other points. The defendant argues that the injury triggers actual knowledge. Well, injury doesn't tell you anything when what's happening is the company's not performing as well as maybe it had in the past. That doesn't tell you anything. What really would have told these people something happened in 07 when, for the first time, the company couldn't pay the repurchase obligation and the company got into trouble with its bankers and defaulted. That would be the only time that you'd really have suspicion that there was a problem, but even that wouldn't tell you that there was fiduciary wrongdoing. As far as Evolve being dismissed, on the plan's knowledge, briefly, that was the issue on summary judgment number one. And the court rejected their argument that the plan's knowledge was the basis for actual knowledge. The statute is very clear. Plaintiff It's got to be the actual knowledge of a plaintiff. The court cases that have dealt with this issue have made it clear that the legislative history, if there was any intention for the plaintiff to be to consider the plan, the legislature would have said so. It didn't do that, and the courts almost universally looked to the plaintiff and only the plaintiff for whether they had actual knowledge. One last point. Mr. Shire argues that the plaintiff must have had actual knowledge because we had enough knowledge to sue. That argument conflates the evidentiary support for facts under Rule 11 with the actual knowledge standard under Section 413. They are two different things. All we have to know to bring a case is that we either think that there's evidentiary support for our case or we believe that discovery will produce the evidence to support it. Frankly, we did get information prior to filing suit. We met with Barry Hoskins, but we never had a chance to put that in our papers. We asked this court to do the right thing here. Process was abused. We asked for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. And our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.